There is no such thing as too much laughter, my father says, drinking in the perseverance until everything disappears. I'm outside, counting minutes, waiting for the man, my father, to finish his shot and take me home before it gets dark.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Lauren Korn, talking with Raymond Antrobus, a poet whose collection, The Perseverance, examines his deaf experiences alongside meditations on loss, grief, education, and language both spoken and signed. Raymond Antrobus was born in London to an English mother and Jamaican father. He is the author of Shapes and Disfigurements, To Sweet and Bitter, The Perseverance, and the forthcoming All the Names Given. Raymond, welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm hoping you might be willing to read one of my favorites from the book, Happy Birthday Moon.
Ah, sweet. Okay. Happy Birthday Moon is the name of a children's picture book by an author called Frank Ashk. I think I'm saying his name right. But it's the picture book that I wanted my dad to read to me every night before bed. And the question that this poem asks, I think, of me, or the question I was asking myself as I was writing this poem is, you know, where does language begin for me? And I realized how many memories I had of my father reading me this children's picture book. And he would read it to me not knowing I was deaf, but he would do this very kind of deaf-aware thing of having me on his chest, where he had this very kind of strong, deep voice so you could feel his voice. And then he had the book out in front of both of us so we can see the pictures and we can see the story. And the story was a bear who lives out in the woods and in this one particular day climbs the highest hill, looks up at the moon, looks over the valley and the river, and the bear says, "It's my birthday." And the bear's voice echoes through the valley and he hears his voice. "It's my birthday." And the bear thinks that it's the moon's birthday as well. So he thinks that all the echoes that are happening are this conversation between him and the moon. And he goes on kind of to make friends with the moon. I love this book. And the poem honors the book, Happy Birthday Moon, and my dad, and this idea of where does language begin. Dad reads aloud. I follow his finger across the page. Sometimes his finger moves past words, tracing white space. He makes the moon say something new every night to his deaf son who slurs his speech. Sometimes his finger moves past words, tracing white space. Tonight it gives the moon my name, but I can't say it. His deaf son who slurs his speech. Dad taps the page, says, "Try again." Tonight it gives the moon my name, but I can't say it. I say, "Rainan Akobok." He laughs. Dad taps the page, says, "Try again." But I like making him laugh. I say my mistake again. I say, "Rainan Akobok." He laughs, says, "Raymond, there's something else." I like making him laugh. I say my mistake again. "Rainan Akobok, what else will help us?" He says, "Raymond, just something else." I'd like to be the moon, the bear, even the rain. "Rainan Akobok, what else will help us hear each other? Really hear each other." I'd like to be the moon, the bear, even the rain. Dad makes the moon say something new every night and we hear each other, really hear each other. As Dad reads aloud, I follow his finger across the page.
Thank you. Is poetry a place where you are able to confirm or where you have to prove your identity or identities, as the case may be?
Not really. I mean, I think poetry is, for me, been a place where I've gone to work something out, to explore something, as opposed to affirm something. But that has also happened. Poetry has been a way, I think, to affirm parts of my identity. But that honestly was never a kind of conscious strategy. It's not something that I did like, yes, I'm going to affirm the fact that I'm a son. I'm somebody's son. I'm going to put that in poetry, right? But at the same time, there is a place for all of that. And I know, it's funny. I was just having a conversation with a student I'm currently mentoring about this. She said that she doesn't like any contemporary poetry because she said that it feels too political and identity based to her. And I thought, oh, well, why do you think that? You know, I was trying to explore that. I mean, I asked her, well, what are the poets that you were reading? And she said, well, Emily Dickinson, Christina Rossetti, Elizabeth Bishop, you know, all these. And then I said, well, it's interesting that all of the poets that you're mentioning are white women. So I think there is something, you know, in identity that you might be missing in you know, these 19th century poets that you're referring to. So like it's a weird thing when people talk about, you know, poetry and affirming identity and, you know, language. It's kind of inbuilt to the technology of language. The way you use language is going to it's going to say something about you and your background, where you're from and your education, all that kind of socioeconomic stuff. It can't be hidden. So even in sign language, it's there. I remember being at school and then there was certain peers and classmates who'd get singled out for the way that they signed. And the way that they signed might have been a more like working class or kind of, yeah, abbreviated, more kind of slang-based sign. So there's no escaping the kind of, I don't know, projection of language.
I mean, in that sense, you know, sign language too operates like an oral language where there are dialects, right, and there are, you know, judgments based on those dialects too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So your bio states that you identify as both lowercase and capital D deaf. Can you explain for listeners the difference between those two terms? And further, I guess I'd love it if you talked a little bit about what deaf culture is for you and what constitutes that community for you.
Yeah, so small d deaf is basically someone who is talking about deafness solely as a kind of medical lens. Often people who call themselves small d deaf would be people who became deafened later on in life and often don't have the kind of cultural understanding or cultural nurturing of deafness as a culture, as a history. Whereas capital D deaf are usually people who are born deaf or active in the deaf culture. They may have gone to a deaf school, and talking about identity and affirming identity, like that's a way to affirm the identity of deafness. And I'm kind of in between both of that because I was born deaf, but it was diagnosed late. I went to a deaf school, but I also went to a hearing school. I learned sign BSL quite late, around 11, 12 years old. And then I kind of had this thing at school where if I'm honest, I was ashamed of it. I was embarrassed. I mean, I stopped signing altogether. I deliberately stopped learning sign, or I would stop signing when people who weren't deaf could see me. I would just stop. So there was all of this kind of shame that was around it. And really, it was only kind of 5 or 6 years ago now when I lost my dad, and I kind of was writing all these poems about him. And then at the same time, I started writing about my childhood and all of these memories I had of, you know, being to school and kind of learning language and where language began for me, that I'd started, like when I would write and I'd share my work, say like it with friends or editors, they would often kind of be like, oh, I didn't know this about you. Wait, you went to a deaf school? It was kind of like, yeah, I was kind of unpeeling this kind of autobiography of myself, which I hadn't before kind of written about so directly. And that turned out to be something that was really useful for me. And so alongside the kind of writing these very personal autobiographical poems, I then checked into therapy because I was constantly spiraling and I needed to kind of find a way to manage that kind of space where I could explore this through poetry and write about, in some cases, some traumas. But I could write in a way that I'm not relying on the poetry to solve or fix anything that's kind of been unearthed. That was useful. I'm glad I did that. I had a really good therapist out of that. But then at the same time, you know, when you're releasing a book of poems, you want to have some respect for your readers, and you want to know that what you're giving them is poetry and not, you know, a diary entries. So I hope that it's clear that, you know, it's still a book of poems, despite the kind of well, the very personal well in which I've had to keep going back to bring up some of these memories and these ideas and experiences of my early life, my relationship with members of my family.
Well, here's a question about timeline, you know, because you're talking about entering into therapy and that kind of helping your poetry writing, but you're also a teacher who focuses on emotional literacy. So which came first, like entering into therapy or deciding to be this kind of teacher?
You know, the teaching and the therapy, they were all accidents, to be honest. I was only trying to be a poet. I was just trying to write poetry. Like when I left school, one of the best teachers I had, she really supported me, but I remember her kind of being really worried about me leaving school. She just wanted me to leave school and figure out who I am, right? And what she meant by that is figure out how to be a deaf person in a hearing world when you're denying that you're a deaf person. Because in school, I did have a deaf community. I did have some deaf friends, and I did have teachers of the deaf who were deaf aware and had that language and the understanding. But then once I left school, I just kind of cut all of that off. And my teacher that I'm talking about, she knew I was going to do that. So I would go through the workforce. You know, I worked as a lifeguard, as a receptionist for a gym. I did currying, I did warehouse removals, leafleting, like loads of jobs. It's quite embarrassing to say this, but like every job I would lose. I'd lose every job, and it was all 9 times out of 10 it was the same reason. It was like someone was giving me an instruction, I would pretend to understand and do something very different. So I end up looking just so incompetent. So through that, I would still be kind of going home and I'm reading and writing. That's always kind of been something I've done my whole life. I've always kind of been a journaler and a reader. And that's something that like both my parents kind of had. They both had a love of poetry. My grandfather was a poet as well as a preacher. So I had, you know, some really serious privilege in terms of culture capital, you know. I end up winning in 2010. I end up winning a slam, which is, if you don't know what slam is, it's competitive poetry, you know, da, da, da. And it was like the Farrago London International Championship. And so the prize was a trip to Chicago to perform in a poetry slam at the, you know, the birthplace, quote, birthplace of slam at the Green Mill. I got there and I performed. And I met this poet in the audience, came up to me afterwards and said, oh, you know, I enjoyed that. You need to meet my poetry teacher, a man called Peter Kahn. He used to come into to the school. So he invited me into the school and I meet this English teacher / poetry teacher. And I'm coming into the school like after school hours. So I walk into a room and I'm seeing about 50 students in this room after school writing poetry. You know, and they're there on their own terms. And it was the first time I ever seen anything like that. It blew my mind. I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I wish I had something like this. And all these students shared their poems with me. And then Peter Kahn kind of, he just observed how I interacted with his students. And then he said to me, I'm going to keep you in mind for something. Good to meet you. Best of luck. 2 years later, I'm in London. Peter Kahn shows up in London and says, hey, I'm starting a poetry master's program at Goldsmith University in London. I'd love you to pilot it and be one of the first students of this course. I went through that through 2 years of just kind of studying teaching, but studying teaching as a poet and as a spoken word performer. And so I could apply pedagogically all of the kind of things that I'd learned, I guess, through slam poetry and through performing poetry and writing poetry to my practice as a teacher. And then we did all of these kind of social studies, and we were kind of we've kind of seen ourselves as agents of social change, because there's, you know, anyone who works in education is going to see how much in it is broken, especially when we think about creativity and how creative thinking seems to be beaten out of so many young people. But if you bring artists into schools and you try and nurture creative communities inside and outside of the classroom, and setting up like showcases where you interact then with wider communities, other schools, like putting on poetry showcases, which is something that we did for years, like, you know, we started to see a really kind of powerful impact that this work was doing.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Raymond Antrobus, author of The Perseverance. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. So, not only is The Perseverance the title of your collection, but it's also the title of a poem in the book itself. Why did you decide to title your book after this poem, The Perseverance?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I think when you're reading a poetry collection, as you say, there is always that moment when you get to, you know, the title poem. And I think that there's like, okay, this is the part where I've got to be extra vigilant and look for all of the things that are happening in this poem, which ground the overall collection. So in this book, in the title poem, The Perseverance, you know, it's where you're introduced to what the Perseverance is. So it's the pub that my dad used to drink in. And it's the pub, which also, because I grew up in like one of the poorest areas of London, which is now, in the last 10 years, it's one of the most heavily gentrified areas of London now. And it's very kind of thriving in terms of that. And there are good things and bad things about that. But the thing that kind of really strikes me about the gentrification of this whole area that this pub exists on is that's literally the one of two things that have survived gentrification on this road, which when I was growing up, the only thing that was there was a chip shop and a post office. That was it. Now it's like kind of art magazines that are sold there. It is an interesting area, but there sits the one thing, the one stubborn kind of almost like frozen in time piece of language, the Perseverance, you know. And, you know, I do know that the owners have changed, but even they sold the pub, but they kept the name, the Perseverance, you know. So there's just so much history in that. And in the word, it's such a great word as well, even etymologically. So yeah, the poem, The Perseverance, is about this kind of memory I have of being left outside this pub as a kid. And this was a place where I was constantly left outside of, because when I was a kid, my dad was an alcoholic. I think he was really battling. Obviously, kids aren't allowed in the pub. So I'm just left outside. And I remember how many kind of random conversations I would have with people, or different things I would see while I'm just outside. And the poem is also a form. So it's a sestina, the six words that repeat. And so the kind of effect that has is that it kind of a circular kind of thing, where it's someone is constantly returning to this place and to this habit, to this routine that they're in. And it's also a poem about addiction in that way, you know, and how that links with the rest of the book is just this idea of the last line of the poem is, I'm still outside the Perseverance, listening for the laughter. And how that kind of intersects with what I'm talking about in terms of the deaf world, the hearing world, and the way that you're persevering through all of these different kind of spaces and listening differently in all of these different kinds of spaces and time. And the book does that. It kind of moves in and out and around time. So it's not all autobiographical. It's also kind of a historical, archival kind of feel to some of the book, where people from history come in, like Graham Alexander Bell and Charles Dickens and Laura Bridgman, and different voices, different people from significant people from deaf history.
Well, now that you've explained the poem, would you mind reading the perseverance for us?
This poem opens with a line from my dad's favorite singer, who was one of the Wailers, called Peter Tosh. And the line it opens with is, "Love is the man overstanding." And just to say that overstanding is like a Jamaican way of saying, I don't understand that. I am beyond understanding, you know. So the perseverance. "Love is the man overstanding," Peter Tosh. "I wait outside the perseverance. Just popping in here a minute, I'd heard him say it many times before. Like all kids with a drinking father, watch him disappear into smoke and laughter. There is no such thing as too much laughter, my father says, drinking in the perseverance until everything disappears. I'm outside, counting minutes, waiting for the man, my father, to finish his shot and take me home before it gets dark. We've been here before. No such thing as too much laughter, unless you're my mother without my father, working weekends while the perseverance spits him out for a minute. He gives me 50p to make me disappear. 50p in my hand, I disappear like a coin in a parking meter before the time runs out. How many minutes will I lose listening to the laughter spilling from the perseverance while strangers ask, 'Where is your father?' I stare at the doors and say, 'My father is working.' Strangers who don't disappear but hug me for my perseverance. Dad said, 'This will be the last time before,' while the TV spilled canned laughter, us on the sofa in this council flat, knowing any minute the yams will boil, any minute I will eat again with my father, who cooks and serves laughter, good as any Jamaican who disappeared from the island I tasted before overstanding our heat and perseverance. I still hear, popping in for a minute, see him disappear. We lose our fathers before we know it, and I am still outside the perseverance, listening for the laughter."
So like you said at the top, you used a Peter Tosh epigraph in that poem, and there are kind of musical references throughout this book. You know, you're talking about the Wailers there, but you also have, you know, Led Zeppelin's Robert Plant, Seal, the singer Seal makes an appearance. Yeah. There are references throughout. What role does music play in your life now?
Oh, huge. I was a music nerd as a kid, and I loved all kinds of music. So I was way into anything my dad was playing. So he was mostly playing reggae and rock steady and soul, and they were all on vinyls as well. I mean, his record collection is one of the best things that actually, it's the only thing I inherited from him physically when he passed. So I still got those records and love them and enjoy them. And my mom too. My mom's such a vast music taste. So, you know, I really feel, again, that this is one of my kind of main privileges, is the kind of culture capital I had as a kid. She worked at this place called Camden Market, and people came from all over the world to go to Camden Market where my mom was working on the stall. So she just selling her jewelry. So I was a kid, I was there, but I didn't know who Robert Plant was. Like, Robert Plant was at the stall, and my mom was like, "Oh, that man is very famous." And I was like, "I don't care. I care about anything." You know, Bob Marley came to the stall. Bob Dylan came through. Like, you just randomly would see. In fact, Bob Dylan has, when he went to Camden Market, he filmed it. He bought a film crew. And so you can actually watch it on YouTube. Like, Bob Dylan walking down the same passage where my mom worked most of my life, actually, not all her life. But so, like, yeah, so it's kind of a very significant place. Where rock stars, the musicians, the most famous musicians would be. When I was around 11, 12 years old, I got deeply and seriously into hip hop. And it began quite bizarrely with like gangster rap. So I was very obsessed with Prodigy and Mobb Deep, Flip Mode Squad, Busta Rhymes. And then it delved into more kind of what's called like backpack hip hop. So like more kind of soulful and poetic stuff, like The Far Side, Dilated Peoples, lots of American stuff. And then deeply got into like UK hip hop. There's just no escaping it. Music will always be such an important part of, you know, my internal life, as well as the life I'm living in real time. I did make a few embarrassing attempts at making music and becoming a musician, but that wasn't my forte. I think I just couldn't get past the language. It was the writing. It was the poetry. And at one point, I was wondering. I was like, actually, maybe I'm not writing poems. Maybe I'm writing song lyrics. Maybe I'm writing rap verses. Maybe just nah. Maybe it was just poetry.
You've mentioned, and you mentioned, you know, throughout the book that your dad was Jamaican, your mom is British. Now that your dad has passed, do you still visit or are you able to visit? And what's your physical relationship with that place now?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think since my dad's passed, I've actually have a closer and deeper relationship with Jamaica, because every time I'm there, that's where my dad is. That's where I see him. That's where I feel him. Jamaica has a certain rhythm, which is very different to anywhere else I've been, which takes a while to kind of move and understand. Like it's a slower rhythm, but it's more intense. Meaning, for example, once I'm in Jamaica, I have to get rid of the kind of London thing I've got or the city thing I've got, where, say, you walk into a shop or you're speaking to someone and you immediately ask them something. So, excuse me, what's the time? Or how much is that? Or, you know, like that's this very city thing. But in Jamaica, you can't really get away with that. In Jamaica, you've got to acknowledge someone first. Hello, good morning, beautiful day, grateful for the sun. You know what I mean? You need some kind of thing. If you go in with just a demand, you're not going to be treated very well. And that every time I go, it's still an adjustment that I have got to kind of do. It's like, oh, right, yeah, someone is kissing their teeth at me because I didn't tell them how beautiful the day is today. You know, I just said, oh, how much is the water? I'm closer, like, with my cousins and my uncle, because I've been able to kind of go back to Jamaica and speak to them about my dad and the memories that they had of him and like what it is that they're grateful for, you know, in terms of family, in terms of, you know, where they are, but in terms of them staying in Jamaica and my dad not. And it's tricky, like it's talking about like identity and claiming things, it's always tricky. You got to get that balance right. You don't want to overclaim a place, you know, which is something I think I was exploring a bit about, like when I was in Jamaica and I was speaking with people, and then I'll say, yeah, I'm Jamaican, and then they'll be like, no, you're not Jamaican. I was like, oh, wait, what do you mean? My dad's Jamaican. It's like, sure, your dad's Jamaican, but if you've not lived in Jamaica, you're not Jamaican. And I'd be like, oh, what do you know, man? Like, I come here every year. Like, I can claim this. It's a tricky thing. Jamaica is a place that I feel a strong connection with, because it will always be my father, you know.
Raymond, thank you so much for being here on The Right Question.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Lauren. Honor, a privilege.
Look for more information about Raymond at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoag and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Beth Ann Austin. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.